Every time I finish a new play, and I mean literally that moment when I complete the entire puzzle and slap end of play at the bottom, I immediately have to fight the urge to send it to everybody I know, exclaiming, "Hey, here's my new masterpiece!" I succumb to this urge. Every time. I used to liken writing a new play to running a marathon, and I think that is why I'm overcome with a sense of accomplishment and pride when I finish a new play. I want to tell people about the marathon I just completed because it's so freaking hard to do, and not everybody can do it, and it takes training and practice and hard work and look what I did! But this is a mistake. For me, finishing a new draft is not the end of the marathon, it's mile marker 12. Sending the play around at that point is like bragging about finishing the race at the halfway point, then jumping on the subway to go home. That thing I'm so proud of is not even close to ready for judgment. Yet, I want others to look past all the problems and lock in on the potential. The play can be great. I know it can. Can you see it? Tell me you can see it. All it needs is for me to actually, you know, do more than slap end of play at the bottom. All I need to do is craft the thing into the masterpiece I imagine it to be. All I need to do is finish the marathon. If I was able to have a little patience, pause my desperate need for validation, and give the attention the play needs, I could actually end up with something others might respond to. Why can't I just do that? This year, I finished a play, or got to end of play, on something that took me nearly 2 years to write. It's the most sprawling and complicated thing I've written, and I know it shouldn't be shown to the old new play gatekeeping crew, but, I can't help myself, so I sent it. I wonder if subconsciously I'm using the understanding that the play is not ready as a cushion to soften the blow of inevitable rejection. Of course they passed on it, it's not done! My insecurities and my ego are like a two-headed devil sitting on my shoulder. I know everything they say is wrong, and the quiet little angel on my other shoulder knows what it's talking about, but that little angel is a weakling. Let me think if I can mix in another metaphor. Or maybe I should just leave this all right here. Am I reading this bit prematurely? I am, aren't I? I don't even have an ending to my point. Unless I just slap the end on it, I should have workshopped these thoughts some more. Oh well. The end. Friends, welcome to the subtext. For those of you new here, I am Brian James Polak, a playwright and the person asking other playwrights a lot of questions. I do this every month, and this episode marks the beginning of year 3 here with American Theater Magazine. This month I am chatting with C.A. Johnson, the author of All the Natalie Portmans and Thirst. For those of you who are regular listeners, you can hit that little skip ahead button because I'm about to say a bunch of things you've already heard me say 1,000 times. If you like what you're hearing, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you get your podcasts, and please do share it with your friends and your frenemies. If you want to follow the subtext on Twitter, find it at Subtext Podcast. And if you have something you want to say and you need more than 200 and something characters to say it, send an email to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. But you know what? People don't really email much anymore. All right, here we go. C.A. Johnson hails from Metairie, Louisiana, but currently lives and writes in Queens, New York. Her plays include All the Natalie Portmans, upcoming at MCC Theater in New York City, Thirst, now playing at Straw Dog in Chicago, The Climb, An American Feast, and Mother Tongue. She is currently the tow playwright in residence at MCC Theater and a core writer at the Playwright Center in Minneapolis. She was previously the 2018 P73 Playwriting Fellow, the Larks 2016-17 Van Leer Fellow, a Dramatists Guild Fellow, a member of the Civilians R&D Group, a member of the Working Farm at Space on Ryder Farm, and a 2018 Sundance Theater Lab Fellow. She and I sat in a chilly backstage area at Straw Dog Theater in Chicago, the day of the opening for her play, Thirst.
Am I introverted?
I mean, I guess all us writers are introverted to some degree, right?
Yeah, but I'm one of those cheats. I'm sort of like, I'm like pretty social.
Yeah.
Pretty extroverted, but I think the ways that I'm introverted surprise me.
Oh, yeah?
So I don't like to be alone too long. I really like being around other people, and I think I'm even in the theater because I love actors.
Yeah.
And I love how extroverted they are.
Yeah.
And so I get really excited about being excited and about company.
Yeah.
But then I hit a wall, and it's like my playwright self comes out and is like, that's enough.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You got to retreat.
Yeah. which, like, I don't know. Those crappy online versions of the Myers-Briggs you can take,
yeah.
And they're completely inexact.
Right. Yeah.
But the few times I've done them, I either get INFJ or I get ENFJ.
Uh-huh.
But it can't quite decide if I'm an introvert or an extrovert. Which, you know.
Yeah. It sounds about right, though, yeah. The way you describe yourself,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
In the middle. I'm consistently I mm-hmm. when I take it, but the... I've taken it like 3 or 4 times because I remember it was the first time, I was like middle school or something when you take these things for the first time.
Hmm.
And or I might have been like a freshman in high school. I just remember being young and not sure, when you're young, nobody knows who the hell they are.
For sure.
But this was like the first thing to define me.
Hmm.
Like, this is who you are. This is what your personality is because this test told you so, right?
Yeah.
And I remember I had this notebook that I kept for years and years, like through college.
Mm-hmm.
And in it was the very first Myers-Briggs test I took. And it was folded in half and it was right in the inside cover.
Oh.
And so I have it at home right now. I could go back and look up and see. And so what happened was I took it and I didn't like the results. And it said, I don't remember what it said, but it was like INFJ or something. And then it had like the boxes that say what each of the things means. So this is what the I means. This is what the N means. And I crossed things out. And I'm like, no, that's not what it means. I'm like this. And I drew like arrows into other boxes because I'm like this. I just found like my best self out of all of the little descriptors.
I kind of love that.
Yeah. Oh, my phone just went off. That's actually the first time that's ever happened. I usually remember to turn my ringer off.
I feel like the one problem, we'd all be better off if we treated those like Myers-Briggs, whatever that other one is that tells you you're something like, you're the aristocrat. You're the,
right, yeah.
Whatever that one is.
BuzzFeed.
Yeah, it like, we'd all be better off if we recognize that they're actually closer to astrology than they are to anything else.
Yeah,
you
right,
know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm the kind of person I've recently, in recent years, gotten super into astrology because I think it's fun.
Yeah.
Not because I think it's fact. Like,
yeah.
It only works if you go, that could be me.
Yeah.
And then you make a different choice.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
It's telling you your defaults. You can change your defaults.
Sure.
Yeah. But you were already doing that. You were like, correction.
Although I wanted to be, I was aspiring for, I was changing my aspirations, really.
Yeah.
Because it probably was fairly accurate for the really not particularly complicated 14-year-old me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be more interesting and more complicated.
Yeah. I think that's what they're for.
Yeah.
I think that's what they should be for. I don't know. I don't think I actually know the context in which somebody takes Myers-Briggs besides being interested in it.
It was some, I remember it was school and it was some kind of like class I was in school. I don't know. It might've been some like humanities thing.
No.
Who knows?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. It didn't say I would end up becoming a writer. Although I bet you when I was 14, I would have said I'm going to be a writer just because it sounded interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
I used to say I was going to be a journalist.
Oh, yeah?
Really?
From, like, an early age?
Yeah. I don't remember a lot of that, actually, but I have an aunt who's my mom's eldest sister, and she's the eldest of 12, and she has no children, and she has this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of all of my grandparents' progeny, because it was her job.
Yeah.
to hold all the truths, I guess.
Yeah.
And she loves to, like, pull you aside and remind you of crap you, like, have no recollection of. And she's like, remember when you wanted to be a journalist? And I'm like, no. And she's like, you like, chosen the colleges you wanted to go to. You told me about them all the time. And I'm like, I don't know if that's true, but I also know that you only speak truth. So, yeah. like, it yeah. has to be. And I really vehemently was like, journalism is where I'm going. And when I try to actually think about that being a thing I truly wanted, I'm like, there is no way that was true. I think it was some sort of performative, I'm going to get out narrative that worked.
There was some kind of, being a journalist represented something that you aspired for.
Yeah, but you know. I don't, and I wrote for the newspaper in high school, and I was okay at it, but it just required you to know how to string sentences together and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But I didn't, I can't imagine there was true passion attached to it. I think it was just a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, because we had to have a thing we wanted to be when we grew up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a suburb of New Orleans called Metairie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like kind of back and forth. My mom lived in Metairie. My dad was also from Metairie, so both branches of my family are from the same neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad's family had sort of ventured into the city, and some adventured beyond the state and into other places, and so they were just a little more worldly, mm-hmm. and a little more city folk. And so depending on the year, depending on what was happening with schooling, depending on what was happening with my mom and all of my siblings, I could spend all my time in the suburb or all my time in the city.
Was it suburban? Like, I don't know what Metairie's like.
It is suburban, but it's, when I go to true suburbs, right? Like when I go to like the suburbs of Chicago or mm-hmm. like little pockets of Connecticut where things look similar, where it's very clear that
you're in...
Dictionary
definition of suburb.
Yeah, that's not where I grew up. Yeah. Because, you know, so much of Louisiana is flat, so much of it used to be swamp and all these other things. And so, you know, there's New Orleans proper, and then you're just in not New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like it suddenly becomes a suburb. A lot of the shapes of things are the same. The houses are farther apart, and there are more lawns, for sure, and there are fewer shotguns. But it... I don't know, it... There, at least where I lived, maybe it was too poor to have ever looked like a suburb. Like it was just, mm-hmm. I didn't realize it until I was much older, but the neighborhood where I grew up, which is like this tiny little neighborhood that's sometimes called Little Farms and sometimes called Bunch Village. It has many names depending on who's pointing at it, but it's only like 8 blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And like on one side is a railroad track and on the other side is a canal and mm-hmm. it's sort of cordoned off.
So it has like these really defined borders.
Yeah, it has these super defined borders and like the same people have lived there forever. And it is suburban in that you could run the streets and play hopscotch and like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like in every parent was your parent. Mm-hmm. But it was not... Yeah, it was like a lot of mobile homes, which at the time I didn't recognize them mobile homes. I was like, that's a house. And years mm-hmm. later, I was like, oh my God, those were mobile homes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
But they were so stationary that was our version of.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, technically speaking, definitely a suburb.
Yeah.
I just think that like white suburbia versus any kind of suburbia are just very different things.
Sure.
Yeah.
Was New Orleans like an aspirational place for you?
No, I mean, I like going to the city because when I was in the city, I was with my dad's family and I was usually the only kid.
Yeah.
And eventually there were other kids and I liked that they were there too. But I feel like, my mom's family is a lot larger.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot more people. And I liked that when I was in the city, there were far fewer people.
Yeah.
And, more outings to artsy things. Uh-huh. And I knew I liked that. Though I don't think I ever was like, I can't wait to live in New Orleans.
Right.
I can't wait to be an adult in New Orleans. I was always like, I can't wait to leave Louisiana.
So it was getting out of the state that was the thing.
Yeah. Because my father's family had told me it was a thing. And my mom very much was the kind. My mom had 5 kids super young. And mm-hmm. she didn't, unlike other young parents, she didn't feel any desire to limit us because she hadn't seen things. She very much would be like, what do you want to do? And you'd say, I want to do this strange thing. And she'd mm-hmm. be like, go do it. She mm-hmm. just didn't, she didn't feel a need to be super discerning because she trusted us to be decent mm-hmm. and was also like, yeah, do everything I never did.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'd say things like, I'm going to live in Boston, and have a dog. She'd be like, all right, you do that. You have a dog. And what'd you say now? Like, it was, it's kind of magical, actually. And I knew that I wanted to be elsewhere. And I remember a trip to Boston one Christmas, and there was snow.
Yeah.
And some part of me always knew I wanted to live where there was snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My experience is kind of the opposite, because I grew up in New Hampshire, and Boston was my home city, essentially, because Boston's like the capital of all the states there.
Yeah.
Right. And I just wanted to go someplace where there wasn't snow, because that was the norm. Like, I'm like, what's it like to be able to go outside and not freeze all year round?
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's a magical.
I don't miss it. I don't miss it.
When I went to undergrad, it was in Northern Virginia.
Mm.
And there were days in January and February where I could be in shorts.
True.
I mean, but the Southerners who were there were, like, bundled up. But here, the New England boy was, like, in shorts.
Yes.
And it was, because it was, like, 58 degrees outside, and that was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So I finished high school in D.C., and that was my first taste of what snow could be.
Yeah.
Even though I think D.C. snow is not quite snow.
No.
It's sort of just stuff that falls.
No, but when it happens, the culture there goes bananas.
Bananas.
It's hilarious.
I was just talking to somebody the other day about the year that they had Snowmageddon. And people were like, it must have been so much snow. And I'm like, what's funny is that it truly wasn't. They just didn't have plows.
Right.
The
yeah.
only reason it shut the city down is because they didn't have plows.
And the stores are empty.
Yes.
So everybody's like, we need to buy all the milk and bread now.
No. That much snowfall in somewhere like Boston, New Hampshire, or Maine, they'd be like, eh.
Right, yeah. Or here. I mean, here is even more. Yeah. It's crazy. Is this your first time in Chicago?
Not my first time. So two of my best friends from college are based here.
Mm-hmm.
So I always have a way to be here socially.
Yeah.
And I did a summer program in high school here. Where I just lived here for a summer and took a bunch of classes.
With Northwestern?
No, it was at Columbia College Chicago.
I've heard of one at Northwestern that people have talked about.
I also heard about that one. This one, I don't even know if they still do it. Columbia College Chicago used to have something called the High School Summer Institute.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I won a playwriting competition in high school, and I used all my money to pay for going to this institute. It was like what I wanted to do. And I came, and I went to Columbia College Chicago, and I took a class in fiction. I took an acting class, and I took an interior design class, where I learned that I'm not so good at interior design, but I really like drafting.
Yeah,
but I'm no good at the actual part that requires visual.
Like the detail,
right? Yeah, and taste, that kind of taste. I think, I don't know what flooring looks best with what wall. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But when we were at the tables drafting, I was like, this is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're good at Tetris, right?
I'm okay at Tetris. So I wonder what that means about whether I was actually good at drafting or I just really liked it.
So you said you wrote a play in high school. Was that when you started to write?
No. So I started writing pretty young. The earliest I can remember being like, I like writing stories was about fifth grade. I had an in-school assignment where we were all supposed to write our own Greek myth. And the teacher had given us all, like, an allotted amount of page space for this little booklet she was putting together. And at some point, she was like, that's running long. Like, you still going? And I was like, it's got to be perfect. So I think that's my earliest memory, but I don't think it was the first time I thought, I'm going to write something and it'll matter. And then I don't really remember. My mom had a stroke when I was a kid. In like 1998 or 1999, it was really surprising because she was very young, and I was the only kid awake when it happened, and so it was this whole such a long story, but it was a whole thing where all of my siblings were asleep and I had to make very adult decisions very fast, and so I like ran around corners and woke other adults and said something weird is happening, and
like you went outside,
no shoes, like I just knew that something had to be done, and my mom was freaking out, something was off, and I was at least a kid who knew like I gotta go get other adults because I'm not equipped, but
you had enough awareness to be like I am not equipped,
yeah. And I'm not equipped, and we live in a place where any door I knock on, the adult will do something. But my grandma was literally down the street and to the right. You know, I just had to round the corner and she'd be there. So I just banged on her door until she woke up. But it was a whole thing. And afterwards, I remember I set myself on this mission. I was like, I have to write it down. I have to write it down, and I just had to get it out. And
like,
I,
what happened that night?
What happened, and I wrote this essay, and I remember when I wrote it, I thought it was so long. It was one page in, like, Comic Sans. And it was, you know, I, like, and it was just beat by beat right. everything that occurred.
Yeah.
And I remember my family got all proud about it, and they had me read it at church. And my great aunt, who was sort of my, like, second mom growing up, had it up on her wall.
Yeah.
And that was probably the first time I knew, like, that I could put something on a page and other people could understand it.
Yeah.
And want to know about it and celebrate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was just weirdly writing for myself after that for forever. And when it was time for high school, I thought, oh, I'll apply to writing programs. I think those exist.
So were you writing these early things that you were writing, were they all sort of like that experience with your mom, things happening in your life that you were
well, what's
putting
funny?
To paper?
Nope. I remember that being super personal. And then after that, I just wrote sci-fi. I had a bunch of years of weird, crazy sci-fi with aliens and new worlds. And then I remember writing... I had a huge fan fiction phase where I was just writing really terrible queer fan fiction for shows that didn't have queer relationships. I would be like, you think you know Harry Potter? What if Ginny and Hermione dated? And I had like amassed a bit of a following online, and that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How did this happen?
I don't know. You just spend too much time on the internet, and you find... I found a fan fiction community, and I realized it was a thing. And I thought, oh, not only can I write stories, but I can write stories with characters. Like, not people I made up, but people who are real, who people right. watch on TV.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
granted, I'm not writing the TV show, but people who watch the TV show are liking my version of the TV show. That's yeah. pretty cool.
Uh-huh.
There's another playwright, Celine Song, who also had a pretty intense fan fiction phase. And we've been talking a lot about how we think there are a lot of writers out there whose first real dabbles into true drama were fan fiction.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about it. We all need to just come out of the closet. Because it was, I mean, it's all still online because at least the network I used to work write on, it dissolved, but all the stories ended up on other platforms. And right. so if I look hard enough, I can find them. And I love to reread them because it reminds me that I know how to write a plot.
Yeah.
Because when
yeah.
I'm in the middle of a play and I'm like, I don't know how to get from this scene to the next scene, I'm like, you wrote 50 chapters of that one fan fiction and it had a cliffhanger every single chapter. Every chapter. It was like... This seems like a horrible analysis, but it was as intense as like R. Kelly's Trapped in the Closet.
Oh, my God.
Which, like, it was
Are you serious?
Heavy and quick. And I don't even know if I ever really listened to all of that because why would I? But I do think, I mean, it was intense and it was serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you writing fan fiction for a whole bunch of different shows?
No, it was pretty specific. I did Harry Potter. I did The L Word. And I did, there was a show, two shows on this channel called The Inn or Noggin. I don't know if it's still around, but it was like the channel that birthed Degrassi.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I watched Degrassi, but I never wanted to write fan fiction. They had these two shows on there. One was called The Best Years, and one was called South of Nowhere. And they were just shows. One of them was like a bunch of college students figuring out like sex and love. And South of Nowhere was a girl moves from Ohio to Los Angeles, and guess what? She might like another girl. and I was like, this is important storytelling, and I must take part.
Right.
And I wrote some pretty in-depth, insane fan fiction. I have no shame. I'm really proud of it.
I mean, while you were writing it, were you like how were you feeling about it while you were writing it?
Yeah. Really passionate. Like, you know, it was those communities are filled with all kinds of people. It's like a bunch of teenagers and then a bunch of adults
yeah.
and like adults who have real jobs.
Right.
One of my favorite fan fiction writers that I read in that time was a doctor. Mm. She would have bouts of not writing and she would apologize because work had just gotten too intense.
Mm-hmm.
But she was so good. And I was like, this is just a writer who's not writing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me feel less alone. I think I was a sad kid, with a, you know, objectively happy childhood, objectively protected childhood. You know, so much of being an adult now is me recognizing the ways that those things weren't true, and the mm-hmm. ways that I was just really resilient,
mm-hmm.
And that I was quite sad and quite damaged. And now that I look back on all that, these sort of passionate pits that I went into,
yeah,
with fan fiction and things like that, were where I could know that there were other people like me,
right?
Who were just as obsessive,
yeah,
you know, just as in need of validation,
mm-hmm.
And also just as delighted by what TV could give us and what books could give us. Like, you just wanted to take part. I think it says something that people didn't just want to read Harry Potter; they literally wanted to go to Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a it's a different thing. I don't think you. I think people had that about the Babysitter's Club. All the girls who were like, "I'm gonna make my own Babysitter's Club." You
right,
know, I think
right.
I think if the world is big and magical enough, everybody wants to be inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're writing fan fiction, you're like, not only do I want to be inside of it, I want to make it.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
You want to build your own house.
Yeah.
Did you stop writing it?
I did. I somewhere in the middle of high school. I think it was when I started having romantic partners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was like, I don't need it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need, my obsession has been like funneled into something else.
Right.
And I think it was like a place to put a lot of hormones, a lot of insecurities, a lot of questions I had about the world. I could just bury inside these weird little stories. And suddenly I had somebody to talk to about all that stuff.
So you're verbalizing it with another human.
Yeah.
Well, a lot in real life rather than with other people, but
yeah,
through the series of tubes.
Yes.
That is the internet.
That, yeah. And I, by then I was at a performing arts high school where I was being asked to write my own stuff quite often.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I had a little less bandwidth because it was hard to sit down and write South of Nowhere fan fiction when I knew that on Monday my playwriting professor was going to be like, you owe me 10 pages.
Yeah, where are your pages at?
Where
yeah.
are your pages? And yeah. I'd be like, well, you know, I was a little busy.
You see, there's this show.
Yeah, it just tapered off, and I rediscovered it in college for a minute, and I was like, this is so dumb. But I think
really?
I just...
Did you... Were you embarrassed by it, though? Because
no.
you seemed to be pretty, like,
I wasn't
cool
embarrassed.
With it now.
Well, I'd forgotten about it. I think there's, like, a little period right after high school where you just try to forget it all happened.
Yeah.
All of it. So I just didn't think about it because I was like, I'm in college now. I'm becoming a human.
Yeah.
And there was some day where it popped up for me. I think I was talking to some fellow nerds about something, and somehow we ended up on fan fiction. And I remember going back to my dorm room and being like, let me look up, see if I can find it. And that was the first time I realized it was all still online. And for
yeah.
a second, I was mortified. Because by then, I was like, I'm going to be a playwright. And I was just
yeah,
like,
yeah.
what if someone finds this? But then I started reading them, and I was in love again. And I remember I tried to write like maybe a few chapters of a new one. I got out about five. And I was like, oh, this chapter's over. Like, I'm done. I'm done with fan fiction, but so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just really didn't need it. I was fully, I think, living in my own life. I didn't need it.
How did it connect to dramatic writing, playwriting for you?
Yes, I think so, weirdly. 'Cause what's interesting is I would in my fan fiction take a lot of specifics from the world of the show that I knew, and then I would infuse those specifics with things from my world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny because now a lot of my plays are very similar in that I infuse something I've assumed about my character with all the tiny things that I know. I still feel like sometimes when I'm writing a play that I'm writing fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel that different. I have a play that's in rehearsals right now, and it's a very close to the vest sort of play where I wrote it and I thought, well, this is revealing. And it's about a kid with a big imagination, you know, who
mm-hmm.
like, and she's not writing fan fiction, but she, you know, has walls filled with her heroes, and like she's just got this big, big, big idea of what she wants the world to be that doesn't reflect the world she lives in currently. And
mm-hmm.
that's how did you know it's about like how how she make those two things live side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like so much of my life was doing that in my own head that I find it in my work. I think I'm constantly writing about women like me who are different from me in so many ways, but have some core things that are me,
mm-hmm.
who've either they're at the beginning of trying to imagine something else, or they did it. They imagined that something else, and oh my God, they actually made it happen. And now they have to contend with whether or not they did it successfully,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not they're actually able to leave the past in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it is I feel like there's something about that original impulse to write that way that feels universal. That's not about fan fiction. That's not about, it's about like being in one place and wanting to be in another place and mm-hmm. like actually not knowing what the tunnel is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's something that I can look back on and be like, what was happening to me in that window of time?
Yeah.
And all of my plays are about some version of that.
And are you aware of this in process, or is this something you realize as you're going back and looking at it?
It's something I'm realizing as I go. Yeah, I had a few plays that were all about really put together Black queer women, like who from the outside were like, life is life and I have conquered it and I've built this and it's mine and nobody gets to take it away from me. Nobody gets to tell me it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets to tell me that I am not successful. And over the course of the play, people around them are like, but really though, are you well?
Mm-hmm.
Are you successful? Have you handled the things that you needed to handle? Do you actually got you? And the answer is pretty, in those plays was often, oh God, no. Sort of like where the play was headed was that, oh God, no. And then for me, that's just the precipice. And then I don't want to tell the story anymore because whatever happens after that to me isn't the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that it is really, really, really hard work to admit you don't know when you spent your whole life trying to convince yourself that you know everything mm-hmm. in order to survive. And those plays, I didn't realize that the plays were even doing that until I wrote something different.
Mm-hmm.
Until I wrote a play that was a lot more positive, that was about the step where somebody sort of said, oh, this world I'm in could break me. I want to build something else. And once I was writing a play about a builder, I was like, oh, they're the same woman. They're just at different points in a trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'm writing about the same woman. Yeah. I was like, I hope I'm not writing the same play. But I do think there's some, I don't know this direct quote. I feel like I've heard it from a lot of other people now, so I don't even know if it's a quote or if it's just, you know, some summation of something Marsha Norman said. But I feel like she says something about, like, every playwright has their preoccupations. And she writes about trapped women.
Yeah.
And, like, Night Mother is the clearest example we have of that. But you sure, can look yeah. at all of them, and it's a... It is a woman who's trapped in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I write about trapped women too, but I write about women who've built their own trap.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh God.
And their journey is discovering the trap.
Mm-hmm. They discover the trap. And then it's mm-hmm. up to them what they're going to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll be excited when I feel like I've like mended whoever that woman is. She's probably me. But I feel like... but... I'll be excited if I'm like, oh, this one's different. I haven't hit it yet, but they are, I'm circling a drain, thematically. And I, it doesn't bother me. I actually really love it. And I like that every play teaches me something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the first, can you remember the first play that you wrote?
Mm-hmm. It was called 6 Months. I wrote it in high school. It was about, oh my God, it's so funny because I had a play go up in the Cherry Lane Mentor Project last year that in the middle of working on it, I was like, oh my God, this is 6 months. And this is a play I wrote in the year 2016 and 6 months I wrote in 2007 when I was 16 years old.
Right.
And so it was about two women, like a Black woman who was a novelist. She'd written her first novel and she was trying to write her second novel, but missing all the deadlines. And her mom shows up to be like, we're going to get this novel done because mm-hmm. you're my, like, I'm proud of you and you're going to do everything that I always wanted you to do. But the mom's an alcoholic. And so what's happening in the play is the mom's trying to help, but she's making everything worse. And she has a girlfriend who's an ex, who's a white woman, and the mom hates the white woman. And she's like, the only person who can help me finish the book is my ex, and the mom's like, not today. And sort of the journey of the play is like her figuring out how to confer with this woman who her mother doesn't want her around, mm-hmm. but who she knows is probably the only person who can help. And that's all I remember. I have a bound copy of it. I don't remember how it ended or where it went. I remember there was a friend who showed up at some point who was quite funny.
Did you consider yourself a playwright at that point?
I did. I had a my life story is really complicated and far too long to get into in an hour. But I, originally from New Orleans, right around Katrina. I ended up outside the city for a while just because we'd evacuated and couldn't really get back. And in that tiny window of time, I had been with my father's family and my mom, and we were in Atlanta, and my mom's family was in Mississippi, and my mom needed to pool all the money she had to get by for the next few months. So she sort of said, stay with your dad's family. Mm-hmm. I'll take your siblings to Houston and we'll restart there. And mm-hmm. we'll all reconvene in New Orleans when we can. So I ended up hopping in a car with, a cousin who is, I don't know how cousins work, but she's my father's first cousin, but her mom had been my second mother, so she was essentially like an older sister to me.
Yeah.
She just said, hop in the car. I got to go home to D.C. You can live with me. I'll get you enrolled in school. And I'd been doing an after-school program at the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts before the storm. So, and D.C. had a performing arts high school mm-hmm. with an entire admissions process that I just skipped. I showed up. They said, we need to get her into school. There was a federal mandate that public schools had to accept Katrina refugees. Mm-hmm. And they didn't necessarily have to abide by it because they were an application-based school, but they said, well, does she have any writing? And I had one floppy disk.
Mm-hmm. a floppy disk, even.
Right, wow. With some of my stories on it. And I gave it. They gave it to the chair of the creative writing department, and she read it, and she said, she's in. And so I went there writing fiction. It was by that point I was only writing fiction. And even all the way through high school, I was still pretty seriously writing fiction, but there was a playwriting teacher there who was a very stern man. But my ideal teacher, because he didn't really get in your muck. He'd just tell you if it was good or not, mm-hmm. which is the only feedback I ever want. Mm-hmm. And then I'll decide if they're right. Like I don't, you know, there's so many different ways that dramaturgy can work. And I sure. understand the, like, soft-handed version, but I don't need it. Mm-hmm. I'm really, really comfortable with somebody saying, I believed it until page 3, and then I didn't buy it. And I'm like, thank you. I'm going to move on.
And then you'll look at that and be like, from this person's point of view, mm-hmm. it didn't work on page 3. Let me look at page 3.
Mm-hmm. And I'll decide why. I'll decide if yeah. I agree.
Right.
It's mine. So who cares?
Yeah.
But I do think...
And you're like this as in high school?
I was. I was trained to be that way. You didn't have a choice when you were his student because he didn't mince words. And if you got too defensive or too emotional, he'd be like, this is about the work, Jack. Mm-hmm. He would call you Jack when he was upset.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like, this is not about you. This is about the work. Is the work good? And you'd have to be like, I don't know, maybe not. And he'd be like, exactly, try again. Mm-hmm. And it gave us all a thicker skin. Yeah. And I've always been really, really grateful for that. And I think that because he was such a good teacher and because he was so certain that I should be a playwright, I agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then once I was in it, I loved it.
But you were already thinking, I'm a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe your genre or your form hasn't been solidified yet, but
mm-hmm.
I'm going to be a writer. Mm-hmm. Once I wanted to be a journalist, now I want to be a writer.
Yeah.
And then you won that playwriting award,
mm-hmm.
sent you to Columbia,
mm-hmm.
and you're kind of on your way.
Yeah, because after that was summer after like sophomore year. So then it was just junior year, senior year of college, and I knew I had two older cousins who'd gone to, they both went to Smith, and they were like, you don't have to go to Smith, but you have to at least apply. And because I'd visited a few times with them for like alumni events. So it was the only college campus I knew.
Really?
Yeah. And I'd imprinted on it, but I wasn't sure I was going to do what they said. So I applied to a bunch of small liberal arts schools that were similar in profile.
Yeah, in New England?
Mostly New England, a few just because they're women's colleges. So I also applied to, like, Mills on the other side of the country. I also applied to Pomona.
Uh-huh.
Those are my sort of reaches. I don't even remember where Mills is, to be honest. And, like, Hamilton, I think. But I mostly focus on sort of New England. And in the end, Smith was the school I knew best, and they gave me the best financial aid package. And where I come from, you go where the money is. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I immediately went there. And I think some of that was that it was legacy, too. And I had
did you still have that feeling of I need to continue to get farther away from Louisiana?
I did. Yeah, very much so. I just had this impulse that, like, the further I got, the more I could see. Man, I wasn't wrong.
Yeah. Because I couldn't imagine a world more different. Yeah. Western Massachusetts in Metairie, Louisiana.
Yeah.
Right?
But it was, you know, those liberal arts bubbles are useful because they are a bubble for a reason. It's so that you can learn to think.
Yeah.
And I think that they could be brainwashy bubbles because you learn to think like the bubble. But if you're smart, you know, and if you've seen something besides the bubble, I think liberal arts communities are only unbearable when the people in them only know them.
Mm-hmm.
But I come from a very different world. And so when I was sitting in classes and people were throwing around rhetoric about people of color, I'd be like, well, I actually know them. And so some of that's true and some of that's just like highfalutin talk.
I mean, were you hearing this out of the mouths of white people?
Not always. A lot of the time, but not always. Smith had a pretty diverse faculty at points, I think. And a lot of the faculty of color were completely overworked because they had to bear the burden of their jobs and all of our emotions of every student of color reaching out to them. But some of the best teachers I had there were teachers who had also come from not from outside the bubble and had come up in academia and were now, you know, tenure track or tenured, and they loved what they did, but they also like questioned everything that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And recognized that, you know, academia is something we need, but also something that can be a problem and can trap us.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there to learn how to formulate ideas and to be sure of my opinions, because I can be a little argumentative, but sometimes I'd feel really stupid inside an argument because I knew I believed what I was saying, but I couldn't back it up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'll go to Smith and I'll learn how to talk. and I did. I talk more now than I feel like I ever did in my life before Smith. And with like a lot more, I'm far more assured. But I also think, you know, I was trying to figure out my queerness. I also knew that they didn't have majors there, so I could go knowing I was going to study playwriting, but also be free to study a lot of other things as specifically. So mm-hmm. like my first class I signed up for was Playwriting 101.
Mm-hmm.
But like, after that, I also was taking religion courses, Afro-Am courses. Like, I was like, what is the world? And, you know, I got real lazy in college because I also was in an a cappella group. I played rugby. I was really busy socially. So my grades are great, but they were great, but not great.
Yeah, but you're kind of doing that thing that you sort of hope, mm-hmm. you know, a college student would be doing, which mm-hmm. is, like, figuring their shit out and, like, trying stuff out. I often feel like I don't trust the 18, 19 year old who is like, no, it's this one thing and that's all I'm going to do.
Right.
You know? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe take a religion course mm-hmm. or maybe take a
because
whatever.
If you're really going to do it, you come back to it. And I did. I really slacked for a few years. I was taking playwriting, screenwriting, acting, all of it.
Yeah.
And I was really not committing to any of it. I was just like, I'm here. Like, there were people who were theater majors who didn't know I was a theater major because that's sort of how, like, one foot in, one foot out I was. And somewhere near the end, when people started to talk about grad school and my advisor said, where's the play? I was like, oh, right, I haven't been doing that thing I love. And she sort of laid down the gauntlet because she was real annoyed with me by that point. And she was just like, either you finish plays or you don't. Like, I'm not your mother.
Right.
And I'm not going to force you to do it. But you have the time and the space right now. Who knows what you're going to be doing after you graduate? You got to make money after you graduate. So do you want to write a play now? And I was like, yes. And so I wrote my first play that I hadn't finished a play in probably 3 years.
Well, you're not finishing because you were doing all this other shit?
Yeah, and I was afraid. I was pretty afraid. I think, I mean, you know, writing plays is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's wonderful, it's terrifying. And I, you know, I had so much baggage, and my work is so personal that even when I tried to hide behind genre, even when I tried to hide behind some kind of plot device, like, every corner of that play was me, and it was not a time in my life where I was really capable of looking. And then somebody demanded it of me, and I was like, okay, here we go. And I mean, I hadn't written a play in 3 years. I wrote that play, and I won a national competition with that play.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out to UC San Diego, and it was performed by a bunch of MFA actors and directed by one of the faculty. And I like met Naomi Azuka and Lauren Yee and Jeff Augustine, and like just these great, these really, really accomplished people who were still all figuring it out.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, oh, we don't have to know everything.
Yeah.
We can just write plays and not know. All right, for sure. I'm for sure going to do this now. I've decided. 21, I've decided. yeah.
Did that change, I don't know, your behavior, the way you worked, like what you did once you sort of like put that stake in the ground and said, this is who I am?
It at least made me know that when I wrote, I needed to be sure that I wasn't going to be so interested so much now in, like, flights of fancy. Because I was still writing, like, little side pieces of fiction that I was never going to finish because I didn't actually care about them. And bad poetry and little one-acts and 10-minute plays that I didn't like. I'm really not good at short form because my characters take forever to say what they mean. And I used to think it was a fault, and now I'm like, no, I'm just not meant to write short plays. But it is, I just was like, okay, if I'm writing a play now, I'm writing it because it should be completed. And if I realize somewhere through that it shouldn't be completed, I move on. And that was the beginning of that. And so, and that was the beginning of me being the kind of person who wanted to finish things. And when I tried to do that for 2 years outside of school, I was a little unsuccessful.
What did you do when you finished at Smith?
So I was working 7 days a week, which is why I was unsuccessful. Because I was right. I had two jobs. I was teaching. In the mornings, I worked at a coffee shop bakery where I was a manager and a barista.
Were you in like Amherst? Where did you leave the
area? I went
area?
Back to D.C. I went back to D.C. Yeah. So in the mornings, and sometimes in the evenings, but I worked in coffee. And then in the afternoons, I taught. And so I taught writing to high school kids at my former high school.
Mm-hmm.
Most rewarding two, actually both of those are the two most rewarding jobs I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And I had them at the same time, and I was completely exhausted and still in my early 20s. So completely wasted. And I was having such an amazing time figuring out who I was, but I was exhausted all the time. And so writing was next to impossible, and I really wanted to be doing it. And so when I figured out that what I like where I was beautiful but not sustainable if I really wanted to be a writer, I just decided to go to grad school. Because I was like, I'll go there, it's the only thing I can really do because they'll overwork me, and I'll at least finish a bunch of stuff and have some semblance of a portfolio.
Yeah,
you know, in air quotes, what is a portfolio? But yeah, I mean, NYU wasn't even really my bag, because there were just so many of us. But I do think it's the kind of program where you just have to put your foot down and say what you decide what you want out of the program and make sure you get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just no, and it's changed quite a bit since I left. They're reconfiguring everything. But I think I was there in like 2 years where they had an interim director and the program was sort of between, we were the largest class year they'd ever accepted. Like, sometimes I just felt like we were swimming a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be like, fly, birdies. And we were like, how and why? Where?
Mm-hmm.
This is a mess. But I think that that forced us all to start to demand what we wanted. And I think that either you knew how to demand that or you didn't. I think I figured out how to just say, like, this is what I want out of this program, and I'm gonna get it. And I feel confident that I got that. With the professors I wanted, you know? And I think, I don't know if that was true for everybody I went there with. I think I had a lot of anger while I was in program, and I've really let go of most of it. And I think there are people who are probably still
pissed. What was the anger about?
It was about lack of clarity. I think I just didn't always understand the pedagogy. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd say things like, you know, we're training dramatic writers, and you'd get trained in TV and film and play, which I actually think is really smart, really brilliant. It trains you to be a person who can make money. And then you decide if you want to do that or not, but it gives you the skill set. And I do think that that is brilliant. It's a great foundation for a very specific kind of program, but I didn't always feel like the three tracks spoke to one another, mm-hmm. that they understood that they were still crafting a person. And so, like, we needed to understand that our professors understood what the other professors were doing, and mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. the ideas being presented to us felt like they were of a kind. And some of it is, like, the nature of adjuncting and all that. I just felt like, where am I? And so I started to get really specific about who classes I took, and really specific about classes I didn't want to take. When I got into a section of playwriting that I didn't want to be in, I basically sent a message to all my classmates being like, who was willing to switch with me? Mm-hmm. I came to this program for Eduardo Machado. I will be taking a class with Eduardo Machado. I will fight this administration, but I think I don't have to fight them if somebody will switch. Mm-hmm. And one of my classmates emailed me to be like, yeah, let's do it. Mm-hmm. But that's me. You know, I was just like, I'm done. This bureaucracy is stupid. I'm going into a lot of debt. I'm done. And so by the end, I'd taken most of my classes with Eduardo, Susan Laurie Parks, and Lisa Crone. And mm-hmm. that was what I wanted. There were a lot of other great teachers. And some of them I got to sit down with, especially in screen and TV. But like, I decided what I wanted. And I think that the program demands that you do that. But that was easier for some of us than it was for others. And the ones who it wasn't easy for, I just don't know if they got the support they needed.
Can you recognize the impact of those professors on your work?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, my work and my practice. So I ended up choosing my three favorite professors were people who don't really teach writing. They don't teach writing. They have you read things and they talk to you about being a writer. And Eduardo, you know, he gives these really intense writing exercises that I think are things he learned from Fornes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. it's breathing and, you know, it's all that. And then he makes you write stuff by hand. Then he makes you type it out. And then he gives you basically no notes. But he's made you go through the process of putting it down, mm-hmm. putting it down a second time, and then having to breathe really deep while people read your bad scene. Mm-hmm. And for him, he's like, that is the work of writing. Now keep going. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even make you finish a play. You're like, you want the end? And he's like, 30 pages is fine. He doesn't care. And Susan Laurie is similar because she only ever wants to hear 10-minute chunks. And you can work through the play chronologically. Mm-hmm. Any other, she does not care. For her, it's about thinking about process and thinking about your relationship to process. The best note she ever gave me is I worked on one play with her for 2 semesters, and she told me to put it in a – I won't go through the whole thing she said, but essentially she told me to wrap it in a bow, put it in a drawer, and not look at it until I was ready to open the drawer. And she told me to take up meditation because she said your plays get in you, and you need to change the grooves in your brain if you're going to survive them.
Did you?
I did. And that play, I still haven't finished. Whenever I get...
But you went back to the drawer?
I went back to the drawer. I go back to the drawer every 2 years on that play.
Yeah.
And then I eventually have to put it back in the drawer. It is a hard play. But I think I would have tried to kill myself to finish it before grad school was over if she hadn't told me I wasn't ready. And Lisa, Lisa's like... she's actually maybe my ideal because she... wants you to think about theater as a and writing as a moment. She didn't say like what's a play. She'd be like, write whatever you're writing, and when you're done with it, we'll discuss it. Like, you'll finish a draft and I'll meet you at a coffee shop near my house, and then I'll tell you what I think, and then mm-hmm. you keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But in class, we're gonna read plays, talk about their form and like what makes them special, and then I'll invite my friends in and they'll talk about what they do. And mm-hmm. so she invited in like Lee Silverman and Rachel Houck and like these really wonderful artists who talked about how to make theater and how to achieve theater.
But I love that they weren't just playwrights, right?
No.
Like Rachel's a scenic designer, yeah. right? Lee's a director.
Yeah, she brought in an agent. She brought in just like people who work with writers to talk about their relationship to the writer.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, this is out there.
Yeah.
My friend's going to leave now and we're all going to go home. I'm done here. Mm-hmm. And it was for me, pretty freeing because I wanted to be talked to like I was a person who was going to make something someday mm-hmm. and not just like I was a student.
Did it help you understand the sort of like three-dimensionality of making theater?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's this sort of trap that playwrights get in, especially when they're learning how to be a playwright. There's not as much learning about what is this entire form
right.
and the place a play has in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, this is my play, here's my play.
Yeah, but it's completely missing. I mean, that program, I don't know if this is still true, but you didn't get a production.
Mm-hmm.
You got like a stage reading at the end, which I do think is a disservice, but is about money. So I cut him a break. But I think what I missed was recognizing the things that come up. You mm-hmm. got your perfect script, but like things are just going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in those conversations, you realize that like all the other hands in the theater pot are just as capable as you.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I used to stress about stage directions and like how I described the house because I'd read way too much August Wilson
mm-hmm.
and like O'Neill. And I was like, and she sits and puts her hand on the, like, you know, and I was like, nobody right. needs to know all these details.
Right.
Because the director's got you. Also, the designers are really good at what they do. And so like their version of the house will always be more interesting than your version.
Yeah.
And listening to Rachel Houck describe how she, a line in a play that made her own artistic mind explode, I thought, oh, our plays are blueprints. They're just blueprints. And everything that comes after is just as important. And I think you learn that in production, of course.
I know that's a little controversial because I know there are a lot of playwrights that are like, my stage directions are sacrosanct.
Nah.
Like, you can't, if I write it, you've got to do it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, you have to know, right? Like, I think I don't think that my action, so in my stage directions, the actions themselves are not sacrosanct. I think I do a lot of a pause, a long pause.
Mm-hmm.
Or I do, I'll say things like, that hangs, mm-hmm. she breaks.
Yeah.
Things like that. Those are stage directions that are about the emotional range of the scene.
Yeah.
They're about making sure that an actor is fully in touch with every beat, because I think my plays require a lot of beat work for them to not be melodramatic. And that is sacrosanct for me. That I will not budge on unless somebody convinces me of a better alignment. But like they're like, you said she exited. I'm like, oh, I really don't care. Make her go wherever she wants to go. And I love when a director checks in with me. Like, that feels good. But I'll literally say, do whatever you want.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
What do I know? I don't know how to make a stage picture. That's your job.
What was your post-grad school life like?
I
mean, how long have you been out?
Not that long. I graduated in 2016.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't know much, but I knew that I wanted to keep writing quickly. I wanted to keep writing in a way that somebody was requiring deadlines, because I really, yeah. really need deadlines. I mean,
did you have anything lined up immediately after grad school, or did you have that feeling of, oh, shit, now what?
No, I just started applying for residencies and fellowships. I just hit the ground running. I looked at the bios of a bunch of playwrights I loved,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, Dominique Mauricio spent a bunch of time at some place called The Lark.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I'll
yeah.
see what they've got going on.
Yeah.
There's something called a new dramatist. I was just looking.
What is this
thing? Yeah. Yeah, I was just like on the internet, on the Playwright Center website, on that like NYC Playwrights Blogspot website thing, just like every possible thing I could submit to, I submitted to. And right out of program, I got the Van Leer Fellowship at the Lark.
Mm-hmm.
So I immediately, like, once my foot was out the door, there were lovely people saying, what do you need?
Mm.
Here's some money.
Yeah.
Write a play. And I was like, write a play? Really? And they're like, yeah, you're a playwright. And I was like, I'm a playwright? Really? But we're doing this.
I mean, how amazing is it to be affirmed like that?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, with these play development centers, the great thing is that it's all on your terms. You know, they don't have to care about producing. They don't have to ask any of those questions. They're just like, is it the play you want?
Mm-hmm.
That's all we care about. Mm-hmm. We have no skin in the rest of the game. And I've grown to cherish places like that. Any kind of residency, any kind of thing where they're just like, do your thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's nice to write with pressure, but without pressure that isn't about you achieving your best thing. Mm-hmm. Not that when you're in production, the theater company doesn't want you to achieve your best thing, but sure. They've got a lot of deliverables.
Yeah.
And hands in a lot of pots, and it's just a different way of thinking about how a play functions.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, if you've done the, like, navel-gazy version of the play with people who love you and just love that you get it right, you're, like, more armored and ready for the production version.
Mm-hmm.
Because you, like, know the... I find when I've worked on a play at the Lark, I know it far better.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm in any kind of process, whether it's a workshop or a production, and I get a thought that's like, what if it's this? And it hits me the wrong way. I'm like, it's not that. And that's not because I'm not open to it being something else, but I know that that thing is correct. Mm-hmm. And I also know that that thing over there is really malformed, like unformed, and I've never quite nailed it. So if somebody says, what if that's that? I go, that could work. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know what it is, and I haven't known for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I covet any chance I can get to find somebody who'll just work on my play without any agenda, because it just gives me time to figure my crap out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest change in you as a writer from that person in high school that wrote that first play?
I think that I'm not afraid to not know.
Mm.
I think when I was a young writer, I was trying to control my plays, because I think if I was controlling them, then I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a lot more willing to just not know. I'm mm-hmm. a lot more willing to be wrong. I'm a lot more willing to have an actor say, I'm really struggling with the leap from this line to that line, and I think it's missing something. And I can answer saying, you might be right. I got no idea what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no ego in it. Because I trust that we'll find it, or if we don't, we'll find a patch, and, like, that's that.
Yeah.
You just can't be a superhero. And I don't think the work wants you to be. I think it wants you to be messy. And I've learned to embrace that as best I can. Because when I let myself be messy, the plays get better.
I heard David Adjmi speak on something very similar, and it hit me in a similar way, where he talked about how his journey was discovering that when being asked questions by an actor or director, not having to have an answer for it, mm-hmm. and I don't know being a perfectly fine answer,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know not having to mean it needs to change, and it maybe needs to stay the same, and I can't define it
mm-hmm.
or tell you why, but there was an impulse there when I wrote it,
mm-hmm.
so let's just let it be.
Mm-hmm.
Let it be mysterious, and it'll work itself out.
And it's the play that is in production right now has a scene in it that hasn't been right, or hasn't been what I think it should be since its first draft.
Yeah.
And it is a scene that functions, and is a good scene. It's not the scene. It is, I don't know what it is, and every time I go, God, that scene needs something, and I really can't find it. And this will just have to suffice, because it does close the play. It does answer some questions. But to me, it doesn't fill in enough of the emotional blanks that I have about the play.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that when people are like, I don't know about that scene, I don't let them touch it. Mm-hmm. Because if I break it apart, I won't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I'll screw it up. And it functions right now, at least.
And you feel satisfied in that, in that unknowing
I feel whatever. Okay. I feel okay. It's always unbearable. but it being unbearable doesn't give me some kind of conniption. You know what I mean? I think I was so hard on myself. And I think that I've learned that your work does not get better because you beat yourself up about it.
Mm-hmm.
It gets better because you let it breathe. I don't know. And a lot of people are like this, but I'm exceptionally good at not taking care of myself and not being kind to my writer self. Because I have bad habits, I'm lazy, all the things that every writer says, and they're very true, but I've learned to just embrace them. Because I'm not going to change overnight, and I'm going to beat myself up and just not write anything. So I might as well just let myself off the hook and write something.
So you've got Thirst going on at Straw Dog, which is where we're sitting at the moment, and it's kind of freezing cold.
Yeah.
Here. But Straw Dogs Doing Thirst, is this how many productions has this play had?
This is the second. This is production the second of one. Thirst, yeah.
Where did it have its first?
It was at the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown.
Yeah, West Virginia. And then you've got something happening at MCC, is that right? Is that what you're in rehearsals for at the moment?
Yeah, it's my play, All the Natalie Portmans.
All the Natalie Portmans.
Yeah.
When does that open?
That opens, previews start on February 6th, and it opens on February 24th.
Rad. Yeah. And so you're bouncing from Chicago to get back into the rehearsal room there?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That plays a doozy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Despite it being called All the Natalie Portmans, it's actually a play about a brother and a sister in Washington, D.C. who are two teenagers trying to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere in there, the younger sister has an imaginary friend, and that imaginary friend is Natalie Portman.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
We got to wrap up.
Yeah.
But this might be too big of a question to wrap up. I've just been thinking about it ever since you talked about leaving Louisiana. What's your relationship to Louisiana now, and do you ever feel like a calling to go to return for any reason?
I do not feel a calling to return. I go home every year for Christmas, and I've started to try to up that to 2 trips a year just because my mom misses me. I feel like every time I go home, I realize I'm so from that place. Everybody moves at the same speed as me. it's a city that lives in the present moment in a very real way. For all its history, like, nobody's sitting around talking about history.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's just like, today's a good day.
Mm.
Wonder what tomorrow's going to be like. It's a city that's just living. And I do think that that's how I experience time, because that's how I sort of trained to experience time. But and nobody's in a rush. I love that. I'm never in a rush. I hate that about New York. People respect leisure. Nobody's breaking their backs doing work because they're like, later I want to sit on my porch and I want to sip tea. And they know that that's valid. I miss that way of life. But I don't miss the city. Every time I go back, I eat good. I listen to good music. I see family, and the clock sort of ticks, and they go, well, gotta go.
Yeah.
It's a little slow.
You fill up and then you get out.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Mm.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
It was really great talking to you.
Yeah, you did.
And I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Right on.
All
right. Big thank you to C.A. Johnson and to Straw Dog Theater. If you are in the vicinity of Chicago, her play Thirst is playing at Straw Dog through February 15th, 2020. Her play All the Natalie Portmans is running February 6th through March 15, 2020 at MCC Theater in New York City. Music from this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions. The theme song is High by International Pen Pal. The subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and is produced and hosted by me. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is The Persuadables by Hallie Palladino. This play is about how disinformation is weaponized to influence elections. It seems like a pretty vital story right about now.